was a spearwoman who specialized in potent charging strikes. Their ranged attackers were an archer using a mid-range skirmish style and a spellcaster with the wind and needle essences. Those three attackers found themselves in a fast-moving dance with Jason and Sophie, startled to find the pair more than holding their own against superior odds. Sophie was even faster than they were, and apparently impervious to harm. She deflected projectiles with her bare hands, physical and magical alike. When they tried to catch her in area attacks, they hit empty air she had already vacated. Like Valdis, the trio was startled by the skill of their enemy. While they were frustrated at the inability to inflict any real damage, they were relieved by her lack of powerful attacks. They turned their attention to Jason, but found him just as much trouble. Their own shadows had come to life, draining their mana as Jason moved in and out of them at will. At any moment he could appear or disappear right next to them, slashing out with his black and red dagger, or quickly chanting a spell on the move. Although the reach of his dagger was short, Jason's deceptive style proved a tricky opponent. The darkness magic that made up his starlight cloak floated around him, shrouding his movements as a shadow arm snaked out, longer than even the spearwoman's lengthy weapon, to strike with his dagger. He wasn't landing critical hits, but he didn't need to with the terrible afflictions his powers produced. Minor wounds left behind curses, poison, and impossibly fast-acting flesh-eating disease. Jason's powers favored an extended fight, growing steadily more impactful as the fight was drawn out. The enemy's own shadows seemed to have turned against them, an intimate and unnerving form of attack. Jason's afflictions filled his enemies with a growing sense of dread, carrying out their horrifying work on the adventurer's flesh. Sigrid's stream of healing held it at bay for a time, but she could not outpace the inexorable escalation of the afflictions. They continued to get worse while her mana was steadily depleted. Between rapid-fire shadow jumps and raw speed, Jason and Sophie flickered around the trio of enemies like mating hummingbirds. Jason was more aggressive than his normal in-and-out style. His quick attacks left only superficial wounds, but each one was a clock of doom counting down on his enemies. He even cast the odd spell in the direction of Valdis, and the defender madly sprinting back towards the fight. It was only the efficient healing of Sigrid being spread around the battlefield that kept things under control, although she didn't have time to spare to cleanse the afflictions. Jason's more aggressive approach left him more exposed, but he trusted Sophie to cover him. Every time their enemies thought they had pinned him down, suddenly Sophie was there. Most teams preferred a traditional heavy defender, but Sophie was demonstrating the true value of the mobile guardian archetype. When all three of their enemies came too close together, Jason unleashed one of his trump cards, leeches spraying from a cut he sliced on his hand. That could well have spelled the end of the fight if not for Sigrid. Using another of her long cooldown powers, every member of her team, other than the distant defender, gained a short-lived shield that exploded from inside them, blasting away the leeches covering their bodies. Many of the leeches were destroyed on the spot, others scattered across the battlefield. Even the brief exposure left more afflictions behind, but Jason was taken aback. Once he actually caught enemies out, the deployment of Team Colin, his leech swarm familiar, was normally the finisher. Never before had the swarm been so thoroughly and immediately countered. With all their members caught up in fights, Valdis's team faced one more threat. Clive, Belinda, and Neil were gathered behind a protective wall of summons and familiars, ready to attack. The bunker strategy was one of the many the team had developed. It was a place for Belinda and Clive to launch control and attack powers from safety. It also freed up Neil to throw out shields and healing without the pressure Sigrid was being subjected to. Neil had frequently sought out Sigrid for advice over the previous weeks. Their ability sets were similar, and her experience was far more extensive than his. His ability to heal and shield his team was not far behind hers, but she did it while also serving as the tactical core of the team, watching everything and directing her teammates with efficiency and precision. Neil could not help but admire the equanimity with which she directed her team, even as Humphrey pressed in on her. Although Sigrid's team had been caught up in the strategy of their opponents and scattered, they were slowly but surely regrouping. Their discipline and experience showed as they returned to formation, even while caught up in their individual fights. If not for the dangerous spells pouring out of Clive, they might have turned the fight already. The need to shield her team was a key reason Sigrid was too busy to cleanse all the afflictions Jason had levied. The minion wall made going after Clive, Belinda, and Neil an infeasible option for Valdis's team until they had regained a semblance of order. The only attackers they could spare were their own familiars and summons, which could do no more than initiate a distracting monster brawl. On Jason's side was the ominous figure of Gordon, his third familiar, a disembodied cloak floating in the air, within which was a nebula-like cloud of blue and orange, in the shape of an eye. Drifting around the strange entity were blue and orange eyeball-patterned orbs that fired unrelenting beams of blue and orange energy onto the enemy minions. Belinda, Clive, and Humphrey's familiars were likewise present, along with Humphrey's summoned dragon-tooth warriors and Neil's summoned chrysalis golem. The golem looked like an ogre carved out of diamond. With every attack against it, a rune appeared on one of its many facets. Clive's tortoise familiar, Onslow, fired off elemental attacks from the magic runes on his shell as Clive periodically recharged them with his own mana. Onslow was back next to Clive, as was Belinda's lantern familiar that fired bolts of force at the enemy. Her second familiar, the illusory Echo Spirit, was dancing around the enemy familiars, distracting and baiting them. Humphrey's dragon-tooth warriors were normally humanoid figures with bodies of ivory, decked out in conjured equipment provided by his personal space power, Magic Armory. In this case, however, the summons were affected by the summoning die Jason had gifted to Humphrey that randomly affected the form of summoned creatures. What were normally three ivory soldiers were instead a trio of hulking bone gorillas covered in heavy conjured armor. They even wielded hefty iron-shod clubs. The final member of the Wall of Minions was Stash, Humphrey's shape-shifting baby dragon. Stash had the advantage of being versatile, like the team to which he belonged. He moved wildly through the brawling familiars and summons, his form rapidly shifting from one shape to another. One moment he was a resilient bark lurker, soaking up an attack aimed at the gorillas. The next, he was a darting bird, quickly repositioning. The summons and familiars on Valdis's side were, like their owners, fast and attack-oriented. A werewolf-like creature fought alongside a sleek metal humanoid figure that was covered in sharp edges. There was a ball of needles with chitinous spider legs, and a scorpion that fired spines from its stinger. Floating amongst them was a small lantern projecting shields to protect them. Their powerful attacks were blunted by the superior number of familiars and summons from Jason's team, making little headway beyond forcing Clive, Belinda, and Neil to keep an eye on them. The forces protected behind the minion melee were the key reason Valdis's team had not yet managed to regroup. Clive's offensive potential was primarily contained within a single potent spell, Wrath of the Magister. He could charge it up and unleash powerful attacks on a 1 minute cooldown. With Belinda's ability to reduce an ability's cooldown by that same amount, both with an ability and her tattoo, Clive unleashed a mana-hungry but incredibly potent series of attacks. As his mana pool was greater than any two of his teammates, however, he had the freedom to do so. More than anything else on the battlefield, Sigrid was poised to respond to Clive's spell the best, throwing out her strongest shields to intercept. Even then, the spell burned through her protections, forcing Sigrid to follow up with her strongest heals. As with Jason unleashing Colin, it was only the consummate skill and power of Sigrid's healing and shielding that prevented the fight from already being over. For a while at least, Belinda's ability to loop Clive's potent spell was a defining force on the battlefield. She even copied the spell and cast it herself when he was done. It was another strategy they hadn't used against Valdis before, and his team had no idea how long Clive and Belinda could maintain the barrage. They were too busy to do any more, however, and were forced to endure. The failure of Jason's team to finish off Sigrid with their ambush was the defining point of the fight. There was no question that she was the most impactful person on the field, standing bloodied and unbroken with her Valkyrie blonde hair, her piercing blue eyes took in every part of the fight. She was the glue that held the team together in the wake of the enemy's divide-and-conquer strategy. Sigrid was the critical factor in every part of the battlefield. Through the chaos, she fought desperately to bring her team back into order, barking out directions between spell chants. Their practiced teamwork and extensive experience allowed them to make subtle moves to coordinate, even while caught up with more immediate concerns. Jason's team had defined the pace of the fight, but the arrival of Valdis's defender turned the enemy's 6-on-5 advantage into an even fight. The defender's cooldowns were finally back up, and he erupted into the battlefield at Sigrid's direction. Jason and Sophie were pushed back, Jason not daring to dive into the formation Valdis and his team were falling into. He recalled his familiar Shade's bodies to himself as Valdis started attacking them with disruptive force special attacks. The reformation of Valdis's team came as they realized that the spell barrage from Clive and Belinda was finally over. They had to seize the moment and turn the tide, as Jason's attacks had placed them on a ticking clock. Jason's afflictions were past the point that Sigrid could eliminate them while still healing the team. They took one of their sweeping attack formations and moved on Clive, Belinda, and Neil. If they could take out the healer along with Clive before his cooldowns ended, the fight would be over. Valdis launched forward at the head of his team, flashing a triumphant grin at the chance to finally fight on his own terms. Then he saw an uncharacteristically hungry smile on Humphrey's face, and concern flashed through his mind. Sigrid had also intuited that something was wrong, but the warning to scatter came too late. A crystal rod rose up from the ground in the space between the two teams. The air shimmered as tethers of force yanked Valdis's team towards Jason's. Then Jason's team vanished. Cold, dark energy flooded the area. The merest touch opened terrible wounds on Valdis's team as their flesh rotted away like it was recoiling. Belinda's tether had brought both teams close enough for Neil to catch them all in the 6-hour cooldown power he obtained from his Reaper Awakening Stone. Reaper's Redoubt placed his team safely in a dimensional space and flooded the area with death energy. Given that Valdis's team were all afflicted with Jason's necrosis-enhancing curse, Neil's ability was a finishing move that closed out the fight. In the strange, dark dimensional space of Neil's power, the team started receiving messages.
You defeated Valdis Voller. You defeated Sigrid Frame.
As the most capable members of the team, Valdis and Sigrid had put themselves on the line to cover the others, making them the first to fall. The others soon followed, and moments later awoke in the Mirage Chamber control room. Valdis sat up on his platform, glancing between Sigrid and the still bodies of the enemy team still inside. He let out a relaxed laugh.
That was unexpected, Sigrid said.
And just think, Sig, Valdis told her. You didn't want to make friends.
Chapter 5 Departures. In the Mirage Chamber control room, Danielle Geller played the recording of the Mirage Chamber fight for the most prestigious guest ever to visit it. Together they watched the battle between Jason's team and that of Prince Valdis play out.
They used my son's status against him, the Mirror King observed. It seems your son has picked up your knack for spotting people's leverage points.
No, he hasn't, Danielle said. My Humphrey's a good boy.
I see, the Mirror King said. You teamed him up with someone who thinks more like you.
The man is good at making friends, Danielle said. Just ask your son.
Valdis was deeply regretting his insistence on joining Jason in drinking bronze rank liquors. It was the farewell party for his team on Jason's houseboat, and when he saw Jason drinking the higher ranked stuff, he had joined in over Jason's warnings. He didn't remember anything between that and the following morning, waking up with a pounding headache and his father seated at the end of his bed. Now, a few hours later, his team were making final farewells on the deck of the houseboat, although Valdis wasn't saying or listening to anything as he struggled with a throbbing head and unruly stomach. Valdis and his team were packed and ready to leave via portal, having spent the night in the houseboat after the raucous party. They had only travelled to Greenstone via boat originally because of the arrangements made by Emir. Emir liked big entrances, as evidenced by the grandiose arrival of his cloud ship days after Hester had quietly portaled him to the city. There had also been the problem of actually opening a portal to Greenstone. Whatever other nuances a dimensional transport power might have, the universal requirement was that the person with the portal ability had to have visited the destination first. Most of the teams had been portaled as close to Greenstone as their people could reach that was also in the path of Emir's transport ships.
It's for the best, Sigrid told Jason, nodding ahead at Valdis. If he was in a better state, then he'd be making a last-minute attempt to poach your team members.
Valdis looked like he was going to say something, then like he was going to throw up, giving up on the former to avoid the latter. You're not going to make a recruiting pitch on his behalf? Jason asked.
My job, first and foremost, she said, is to keep Valdis out of trouble. You are definitely trouble.
Jason laughed. Next time we see you, we'll all be bronze rank. We might come visit that kingdom of yours and give you a chance for revenge in your local Mirage Chamber.
You do remember that we repeatedly beat you, right?
Sigrid asked. You're only as good as your last fight, Jason said.
That makes us the winners, leaving you to return home in disgrace.
She shook her head.
I still can't fully pass you, Jason Asano. Are you a fool, a genius, or a monster?
Yes, he said, with an impish grin. Suddenly, every member of Valdis's team dropped to one knee, except for Valdis himself. Jason's own team followed a beat later, leaving Jason and Valdis the only ones on their feet. Jason turned around to find a man standing on the deck that he hadn't sensed, even through his connection to the boat. The man was dressed well, but not extravagantly, looking to be somewhere in his late 30s with a neatly trimmed blonde beard. His appearance was unremarkable, but his aura was something else entirely. It was not overwhelming, in fact, just the opposite. Jason could hardly tell where the man's aura stopped and the rest of the world began, as if the world itself was an extension of his power. Another man walked across the cloud-stuff gangplank and onto the deck from the marina. His positioning and posture marked him as a subordinate to the first man, despite his own powerful gold rank aura. He was glaring unhappily at Jason.
You should kneel, he told Jason.
Why? Jason asked.
To show your respect. You stand before the king.
If there's mandatory kneeling, it's not respect that you're looking for. Also, the king? I mean, he's a king, I'll grant you. Certainly not my king, though.
Do you even have monarchs where you come from?
The Mirror King asked. His voice was deep, rich, and tinged with amusement. Kind of, Jason said. We sort out our own business, but old folk like to have a royal or two floating about, so we borrow someone else's queen from time to time.
You borrow a queen?
Yep, Jason said. We pop her over, wheel her down the street so people can have a wave, and then send her back. It works out for everyone.
That's madness, the Mirror King's offsider said. He's telling strange outworlder stories to disrespect you.
The Mirror King laughed.
What he's doing is poking the nest to see how aggressive the wasps are. You remind me of Danielle Geller when she was young and precocious.
Thank you, Jason said.
You'll have to forgive my friend Hastor, the Mirror King said. Among his varied and valuable roles is to be protocol officer, at which he very much excels.
Thank you, Your Majesty.
Sadly, the Mirror King continued, the traits that make him an excellent protocol officer serve him less well in more informal settings. If there isn't a chart to seat everyone in the room by relative rank, he starts getting snippy.
Your Majesty, Hastor protested.
At that moment, Valdis, who had been lurking behind Jason, lost his battle with his stomach. Lurching to the side of the deck, he vomited loudly over the side.
Good thing I ranked up my poison resist power, Jason confided in the Mirror King.
It soaked up just the right amount of alcohol. Also, I apparently don't have a stomach. I was going to ask my mate Clive about it, that's Clive kneeling there, but I figured the answer would be pretty gross, which may sound odd coming from the guy with the flesh-rotting powers, but there you go.
It seems my son has learned a lesson about limitations, the Mirror King said with a chuckle. Those can be hard to find for princes.
Valdis staggered forward to stand next to Jason.
Dad,
Valdis croaked in greeting. The Mirror King gave his son a wry smile.
Having fun?
Valdis let out a wordless groan, and the Mirror King chuckled again.
Thank you for putting up with my son, Mr. Asano. I think it's time to go.
No worries, your kingness. And you can call me Jason. The Mirror King grinned and threw an arm around his son's shoulders, who groaned.
Come along, boy. You can explain the state you're in to your mother. If you would, Hastor.
Hastor called up a portal that looked like a sheet of glass, and the Mirror King marched his son to it. Just before he passed through, Valda shared a put-upon look with a grinning Jason, departing with a wave. Once the king was gone, Jason and Valdis's teams stood up, Sigrid politely moving to greet Hastor. The disgruntled look on Hastor's face softened with their brief and formal, yet somehow still warm, interaction.
It's good to see you, father,
Sigrid said after her formal greeting.
Wait, this guy's your dad?
He is my father, Sigrid confirmed.
And he doesn't get a hug? That's cold.
Sigrid chuckled, shaking her head.
Thank you for the hospitality, she said to Jason's team. I look forward to the next time we meet.
She led the rest of her team through the portal, leaving only Hastor with Jason and his team.
Thank you, Hastor said, to Jason's surprise. While I cannot agree with your gross deficit in etiquette, the young prince doesn't have a lot of friends who will stand beside him instead of kneel.
Hastor didn't wait for a response, stepping through his portal, which then vanished.
That was unexpected, Jason said.
So, Emir's portal lady is Hester, and that guy's portal guy was Hastor, he mused. A portal power's a name thing?
Of course not, Clive said. You need to watch your decorum around royalty.
Do I? Jason asked.
I was more thinking that I need to get powerful enough that they watch their decorum around me.
Standing on the marina, Jason returned his houseboat made of clouds to the magic flask in which it was stored, the cloud stuff snaking in like a genie going into a bottle. Once the cloud house was fully returned, Jason took a large brewer's keg from his inventory. There was a small tap, under which he placed the flask before opening it to letting crystal wash spill inside. Despite pouring out far more liquid than the flask should have been able to contain, it showed no signs of becoming full, taking the entire contents of the keg without even getting any heavier. He didn't restore the houseboat after emptying the keg, as he was taking it with him on his team's upcoming road contract. It would provide pleasant accommodation as they wandered around the desert, although this left Rufus and Gary, who had been staying in the cloud house, without accommodations until they returned. With the conflict with the builder cult at an uneasy pause, Gary and Rufus turned to other endeavours. Gary would be rejoining Emir at Sky Scar Lake, while Rufus would lodge at the Geller Estate as he refocused his attention on his training academy annex project. The fight against the builder cult was at a lull after the raid on their island outpost. The Purity Church was in something of a limbo while everyone waited for word from on high, be that the ecumenical council formed to investigate them or the gods themselves. In the meantime, the people from the Church of Purity were comfortably but thoroughly detained under the authority of the ecumenical council. Once Jason had drained the keg of crystal wash, restoring the cleaning functions of his magical abode, it was time to head out. It was a short walk from the marina to the Loop Line station for Jason and his team, which carried them to the Adventure Society campus. Waiting for them outside the jobs hall was Humphrey's sister, Henrietta. Henrietta was a statuesque and handsome woman whose short cropped hair swept back dramatically. In practical leathers and with a dimensional bag slung over her shoulder, she had the confident ease of an experienced adventurer. Her eyes were a bright shade of purple, a sure sign of a summoned familiar inhabiting them. Belinda's lantern familiar, Shimmer, was likewise subsumed into her eyes, turning them silver. Henrietta was a minion specialist, and Jason knew that she would have her three summoned familiars inside her body. Her fourth familiar was bonded to her like Stash was to Humphrey. It was a phoenix, the classic variety native to the desert. The magical bird was rare and elusive. People lived whole lives and died out in the desert without ever seeing one. It was a gorgeous creature with feathers like living fire, which stood out even when familiars were a common sight. As the phoenix could not disguise itself the way Stash could, Henrietta largely left the mystical bird to its own devices. She was always able to sense and communicate with it. Summoned familiars had a number of practical advantages over bonded types, but the bond was not without its perks. A bonded familiar could be sensed at all times, while summoned familiars only could be while subsumed within the summoner, which was not a practical advantage. The closest Jason had to this was Shade and his three bodies. While Shade's other bodies were out and about, Jason could sense them so long as at least one copy of Shade took the place of his own shadow. It also helped make Shade a useful spy.
"I've already picked up the contract," Henrietta said. "Let's head out."
Every road contract consisted of a group of iron rankers with a supervising bronze ranker. In the current uncertain times, Henrietta had appointed herself to look after her brother and his team. Danielle had also made sure Henrietta had certain expensive magical consumables to use in a pinch. The team turned around and headed back for the loop line. After leaving the station, they prepared to head out for the desert. Clive had arranged for a heavy-duty skimmer that could handle rocky terrain to be kept waiting for them at the edge of the delta. Skimmers specialized to sand were relatively cheap, but the magic that kept them aloft became less effective over a rugged, sweeping area. Knowing they would be ranging far and wide, Clive had requisitioned a more robust model designed for all kinds of terrain. To get to the Magic Society outpost at the edge of the delta, the team deployed their various means of transport. After returning from the trip to Jayapura, the team had new transportation available to them. Humphrey already had Stash, who would happily transform into a Heidel that he could ride. Heidels were roughly the shape of horses and were domesticated for the same purposes, but they had scales instead of hair and two heads. Stash didn't like the colour of regular Heidels, leaving Humphrey riding a bright pink animal. Jason's familiar mount was Shade, who could also transform each of his three bodies into mounts due to Jason's dark rider power. As Jason found Heidel's creepy, Shade turned into a trio of horses. The hair of each horse was black, with white glowing hooves, eyes, and mane. White mist shining against the black coat of the horses rose up from the hooves. Jason would have been satisfied so long as Shade didn't turn into a Heidel, but was delighted with the glorious form he took.
"Looking sexy, Shade!"
"I believe," Shade said. "That comment is inappropriate on numerous levels."
With each of Shade's three bodies turning into a horse, Jason, Sophie, and Belinda all had one to ride. Shade even manifested saddles, although with only a hand grip strap on the saddle instead of reins, bit, and bridle. Jason wasn't a great horseman, but he knew how to ride after family trips to his mother's cousin's farm as a kid. He was at least able to help get Sophie and Belinda get seated on their own horses. Clive had purchased a floating disc during their trip away. It was much the same as the ones they had used in Jayapura, but could function in low magic areas like Greenstone. As with most such cases, it could only be operated by someone with a special power to use magical tools. Neil had no such power, and no shape-changing familiar. He ended up in a floating trolley, towed behind Clive by a magical tether.
"Thus doesn't feel dignified," Neil said, as Clive pulled him along like a child in a trolley.
He looked over at Henrietta, who was riding a Heidel-like construct creature, strangely crafted from what looked like folded paper. It would not hold up to the rigors of combat, but could fold itself down small enough to carry in a pocket, like a two-headed origami horse.
"I should have bought one of those," Neil lamented. He had seen them for sale in the Mystic Quarter in Jayapura, but had balked at the price.
Given the money he still had from the essence auctions, he was now regretting his own prudence.
"I watched the recording of your fight with the prince and his team," Henrietta said as they rode through the city streets.
"What did you think?" Neil asked. "Beating that team is impressive, right?"
Impressive? Henrietta asked dismissively. It was a travesty. You lined up your familiars and summons like they were bricks in a wall. Do you have any idea how much potential you squandered?
As a specialist in using summons and familiars, Henrietta had found the tactics the team had used for theirs painful to look at.
During this trip, I'm going to drill you all until you stop wasting your familiars. Jason is the only one of you even starting to use his familiars properly, and he still has a long way to go.
Thank you, Jason said.
I wouldn't get too happy, Henrietta said. Your performance was only decent compared to the rest of this lot. You left one of your familiars standing around with the others, too. You'll be drilling as hard as anyone.
I don't mind a bit of hard work, Jason said.
Henrietta grinned at him. You will when I'm done with you.
They were making their way down Broad Street Boulevard, one of the main artery roads between the island and the old city's northeast gate, when they all felt a surging aura. Looking in that direction, they could see rainbow light shining over the rooftops from several streets away.
A manifestation, Henrietta said darkly, right in the middle of the city.
Maybe it'll just be an awakening stone, Neil said.
Not with light display of that size, Clive said. That's a monster. Probably Silver Rank.
Silver Rank, Neil said. Do we go?
Of course we go, Jason said. We're adventurers.
I'm not, Belinda said. I haven't had my assessment yet. Does that mean I get to not go?
Jason flashed her a grin.
No.
He urged his shadow horse to a gallop, roaring ahead of the group. Trailing behind him was the sound of hooves on the packed earth of the street, mixed with the sound of Shade's voice.
I would like to remind you that I can talk. You could just ask me to go faster instead of digging in with your heels.
Chapter 6 No Pot of Gold. The people of Old City were reacting in one of two ways to the rainbow light shining in the air. Many were fleeing as fast as they could, rushing past Jason and his team as they rode towards the source of the commotion. Other members of the populace were trying to find a spot to watch from a safe distance. At worst, they would get to see some adventurers in action. Even better would be if it turned out to be an essence. Maybe they would even have a chance at grabbing it for themselves. Jason and his team were not the only adventurers in the area to come running. There was another team of iron rankers in full gear, plus a handful of people with iron and bronze rank auras that, judging by their casual clothes, were just in the area on civilian business. Jason and his team dismounted their various means of transport.
Once the monster manifests, Henrietta said, everyone follow my direction. If there are lower rank secondary monsters, I'll have at least some of you on them. Otherwise, I'll put you on crowd wrangling. The onlookers won't be willing to go until things get dangerous, so we'll need to keep them from panicking and trampling one another.
The rainbow light was emerging from the ground. Chunks of street had broken apart and were floating in the air like dandelions on a breeze as the light rose up from the holes left behind. The assembled adventurers moved up to peer into the holes, seeing through the light that there was a good-sized space below.
Some kind of hub for the water utility tunnels, Clive said.
He had withdrawn a stone tablet from his personal storage space to consult. The magical map etched into it shifted as he pushed his fingers across the surface of the tablet.
That's troubling, Clive said, after finding what he was looking for. There's a wastewater treatment hub right underneath here. It's probably been damaged by a manifestation this strong.
You think that's troubling? Jason asked. I think you're missing the main point.
What do you mean? Clive asked.
Monsters take forms according to their environment, right?
Oh,
Clive said, realization dawning.
What is it?
Henrietta asked. There's no pot of gold at the end of this rainbow, Jason said. I think we're about to fight a poo monster.
Even as he said it, filthy water started geysering up from the holes in the ground. The gathered crowd started recoiling loudly as gobbets of viscous water rained from the sky, bringing a terrible stench. Jason quickly pulled out his magic umbrella, protecting himself from the wastewater rain with the bubble that formed around him. Belinda and Sophie immediately ducked into the bubble with him, as the others looked on in envy while they were rapidly drenched in filth.
"I think we might need another keg of crystal wash," Jason said.
The splashing water did not lay inert after landing. Like a living creature, it crawled over the ground, buildings and even people it landed on, seeking to congeal into pools.
"The rain is the monster," Henrietta called out. "Some kind of elemental."
As the rain congealed into pools, the pools started radiating auras. The biggest pool was condensing a silver rank aura, the smaller ones either bronze or iron.
"Start attacking if you have anything that will be effective,"
Henrietta called out, not just for Jason's team, but all the assembled adventurers.
"Anything explosive or any resonating force powers will be most effective against a water-type elemental. Avoid ice or anything else water-based it can absorb unless you can freeze and shatter all at once."
Elementals formed anywhere that the water was pooling, from the middle of the street to the flat rooftops and even on shopfront awnings. Globulous masses of thick, rancid liquid congealed into gelatinous chunks, until an accumulated pile started undulating in the direction of the closest living thing. They oozed across the ground, spilled over walls, and tipped out of whatever container the wastewater had been accumulating in, splattering to the ground. Jason spotted one elemental secrete its way out of a fruit cart, flowing between the fruit like some unholy juice.
"Like a less awful kale smoothie," he muttered to himself.
Gordon, who inhabited Jason's aura, was much easier to draw out than Colin, who lived in his bloodstream. All Jason had to do was project his aura the right way for Gordon to appear at his side, and soon blue and orange beams of force were gouging their way through elementals. Jason's afflictions would be worthless against the elemental's own powers, so he drew his sword, although he knew he would be more use directed elsewhere.
"I'll be better off on crowd control," he told Henrietta. "This is a bad matchup for me."
Henrietta nodded. "You know your team better than me," she told him. "Set the roles." Jason had Sophie join him on crowd wrangling, as her speed was more useful than her fists against the ambulatory sewage monsters. The others he assigned to elemental hunting. Humphrey's powerful attacks could smash an elemental apart, rendering the magically infused water inert once more. Clive had his legendary staff tucked under one arm, and his legendary wand in the other hand, blasting out force energy from both. Neil kept an eye on the whole field, shielding and healing anyone who needed it, from their own team to other adventurers and civilians. Belinda chained her force tether to collect elementals together where all the adventurers could lay on area attacks. The other adventurers had also leapt into action as elementals emerged across the sprawling area of streets, alleys, and rooftops where the wastewater rain had fallen. That included Henrietta, who called her familiars into play. She let out a breath that became a dervish of ash and cinders that charged into the liquid elementals, evaporating them into clouds of foul, choking steam. Purple light poured out of Henrietta's eyes, from which manifested a huge, bizarre floating eye, held aloft by leathery wings on either side of the orb. It flew around, projecting a beam of purple energy that blasted the elementals apart. The last familiar was a lantern emitting soft green light that healed any living thing it encountered. She sent it floating off in search of civilians caught up and isolated by elementals. Even Henrietta's previously absent phoenix appeared, diving out of the sky like a burning spear. In a series of swooping strikes, it punched through elementals, their watery bodies exploding with sprays of filth and steam. Having put her familiars to work, Henrietta employed a power not unlike Clive's ability to draw ritual circles. Hers, however, was specifically for summoning creatures. Where most people would have to lay out a circle of salt or other appropriate substance, she drew a simple magic circle in the air with her finger, which was traced out in silver-blue light. She was done in moments, and the circle transmuted into a shimmering portal, through which came one summon after another. The first was a crow made of golden fire, superficially similar to the phoenix, but formed entirely from golden flames with burning red eyes. It soared out of the portal and joined the phoenix in its swooping strikes. Next through the portal was a winged centaur, clad in armor and carrying a shield and lance. It galloped into the fray, smashing apart elementals with sweeping shield bashes and crashing blows from its own wings, used as bludgeons. The third entity to come out looked like a strange, dark angel,
It had no arms but four wings, two black and two white. Around it floated four disembodied hands. It flew into the air, looming over the chaos and sending out the floating hands. Where they touched an ally, the ally was healed. Where they touched an elemental, the elemental was desiccated. The hand would push into the elemental as it reduced down to a dry, hard nugget of waste before floating off again. The final summon was a golem made of crude iron, glowing with internal heat. Similar to the forge golem Jason had seen Gary summon in the past, this furnace golem had flames behind the metal grill in its torso, rather than molten metal. There was no shortage of elementals to go after, as more and more kept forming. The geysering wastewater continued unabated, and the filth rain kept coming down. As some focused on eliminating the elementals as quickly as possible, Jason, Sophie, and some of the other adventurers spread out to help people. The rain had come down farther afield than anyone had anticipated, seeping under doors and into the buildings around them. After designating roles, Jason couldn't spare any more attention to what the rest of the team was doing. He used the voice chat to keep in touch, but mostly it was left clear for Humphrey, Clive, Belinda, and Neil to coordinate. It was his evolved map ability that he relied on the most. It now had the ability to pick out friends, enemies, and neutrals. Jason ran around, with Gordon trailing behind. Jason kept one of Shade's bodies with him to communicate with the two he sent scouting. The mana-draining power of Shade's even turned out to be effective against the elementals, which were basically magically infused physical matter. Draining the magic out of them had a strongly deleterious impact on their integrity. He fought elementals as he had to, his sword proving sufficiently effective. It was sufficient at least to extricate people from where they had been boxed up so he could find them a path out of the rain. He relied mostly on his familiars to begin with, while he accumulated power on his sword until it was slicing through elementals at a blow. People were scattered, panicking, and making all the wrong decisions. Elementals came into their homes and businesses, and they ran exactly the wrong way. It was like herding cats in a thunderstorm. With the spread of people and the rain coming down on a whole range of streets, alleys, and buildings, Jason didn't always reach people in time. Some he found dead, drowned in viscous filth. He didn't have time to reflect on how inured he had become to death, but was already looking for the next person he could save. It seemed like the geysering wastewater would never come to an end. More and more of the foul fluid poured into the sky, raining down to form yet more elementals. The smaller iron rank ones coalesced first, followed by the larger bronze rank ones. The adventurers had mostly cleared out the panicking innocents by the time the largest pool congealed into a towering silver rank elemental. At the height of a two-story building, it loomed over the adventurers battling its lesser kin. Fortunately, its formation finally saw the geyser of filth peter out. More adventurers had arrived as the battle continued. Henrietta and the other bronze rankers were gearing up to confront the giant elemental when the first silver ranker arrived. With dark, waving hair, broad shoulders, and huge hammer, he leapt from the roof of a nearby building. He had arrived after the filth rain stopped, but was quickly coated in muck as great chunks exploded off the elemental with each swing of his giant hammer. It was a huge lump of metal, even the handle, but he waved it about as if it weighed no more than a stick. The arrival of the silver ranker and the end of the rain forming new elementals signaled the turning point of the fight. Each rank of adventurer turned to the matching rank of elementals, which were cleaned up in short order. In the wake of the battle, the adventurers gathered up, mostly covered in filth. A few had shielding abilities that protected them, while others were already using crystal wash or similar items to clean themselves. Jason tossed a bottle of crystal wash to the silver ranker who was now covered in muck. "Thanks," the adventurer said, as he tipped the bottle over his head. This restored his square-jawed handsomeness and lustrous, wavy hair. "From that cloak you're wearing, I'm guessing you're the Jason Asano people have been talking about." "That's me," Jason said. The adventurer looked over the team forming around Jason. His eyes fell on Sophie and Belinda. "That would make one of you two Sophie Wexler?" "Why would you have heard of me?" Sophie asked, as she took one of the crystal wash bottles Jason was handing out. "The Adventure Society director had a friend of mine following you around in secret for months. He was the one quietly intervening to help you avoid being caught. He wasn't allowed to talk about it at the time, of course. A bit ethically shaky, but there you go. I met him briefly, Jason said.
Oh, I know, the adventurer said, with a laugh. You got him told off, so he hates you.
Henrietta approached the group, nodding to the silver rank adventurer.
That was good timing, Bert.
Henry, it's been a while, the adventurer greeted back. Wait, Jason said.
You're Bertrand Bertinelli?
You can call me Bert, Bertrand said.
Wow, Jason said. You really are the handsome one.
Chapter 7. The Glory of Success or the Price of Failure.
Bertrand was the ranking adventurer, which made reporting the elemental manifestation to the Adventure Society his responsibility. As he was a latecomer to the incident, Henrietta diligently filled in the blanks in his knowledge. The team was happy to leave sorting out the mess of the filth-coated streets to him. Civilian casualties needed to be tallied and reported, and repairs and clean-up organized. Through some meteorological quirk of magic, it never rained in Greenstone. All the waste would need to be cleaned off before it dried into the walls. If nothing else, the untreated wastewater would pose a health risk if not dealt with. Bertrand was commandeering the services of some of the other adventurers present as Jason's team left. Their travel contract fortuitously exempted them. They had a schedule to keep. They left the city and made their way along the coast road toward the northern edge of the delta.
I've heard that given the events of recent months, Henrietta told them, some of the more remote areas haven't been getting the attention they should. Not all of the villages were covered in the last 2 months by adventurers, which has apparently led to casualties from iron rank monsters that have reached the berserk stage. Bronze rank monsters that spawned in that period won't have reached that stage yet, so we can anticipate a higher than normal number of them on notice boards.
We're going to fight bronze rank monsters? Belinda asked. As the newest and only non-adventurer on their team, her face reflected an understandable uncertainty.
My role is primarily a supervisory one, Henrietta said. While with a less capable group, the bronze ranker might engage in more active leadership, this is a chance for you to show not just ability, but also judgment.
Meaning we choose whether to face off against a bronze rank monster ourselves or turn to you, Neil said.
Precisely, Henrietta said. My role is to step in when I determine your ability or judgment has failed, and the danger has become unacceptable.
If these remote areas we'll be visiting have been this neglected, Jason said, then I imagine there have been messengers sent to lodge complaints.
There have, Henrietta said.
I'm willing to bet Arella picked out a route where we'll be cleaning up messes for her, leaving us to face some unhappy townsfolk.
Assuming that's all she does, Neil said.
Her father's a crime boss and she hates you, Asano. I'm more concerned she'll try and have you bumped off out here, catching the rest of us in the middle.
Arella has a vested interest in keeping me alive at this point, Jason said. She barely held on to her position and the support of the Ramore family was a large part of that. Not to mention that Humphrey and Henrietta are with us. Their mother has not been happy with Arella since the expedition, and if Danielle suspected her of endangering her children, Arella might just be vanished and never be heard from again. That said, I've assumed Arella would make the smart choice before and pay the price for that assumption. It might not hurt to keep an extra eye out.
She won't do anything, Henrietta said. My mother bullied her way into supervising the development of our schedule. She also provided Humphrey and myself with certain resources to rely on in critical moments.
Assuming no one else got the schedule and decided to bury Asano out in the desert, Neil said.
Not everyone appreciates his cavalier disregard for rank and social standing. Even if he hadn't ticked off certain crime lords, which he has, Lucian Lamprey, well-known criminal connections. I also know for a fact that certain elders in the Mercer family really hate him.
What for? Jason asked. Are they still annoyed that I had the temerity to have a relationship with Cassandra?
It was never about you, Asano. It's internal family politics, The Mercer family elders are used to being in charge, and they weren't happy when Lady Thalia came back to Greenstone from adventuring. She carved off a chunk of their influence just by turning up. They knew Thalia approved of you and Cassandra as a match, so they pushed the family to force you apart as a show of strength. They made a big deal of you not being good enough and Thalia not thinking of the family.
I see it, Jason said. They shoo me away from their precious scion because I'm some nobody. Then suddenly I'm swanning about with visiting royalty, gold rankers and even gods. Thalia looks prescient for championing me when I was a nobody, and they look like fools for pushing away someone whose star is on the rise.
That's basically it, Neil said. You don't actually matter to them, but they resent you anyway.
Hold on, Asano, Henrietta said. You and Cassandra Mercer?
She and Jason were together for a while, Humphrey said, until her family pushed her to end it.
Wow. Cassandra Mercer, Henrietta said. I'm envious.
Henry, Humphrey said.
What? Henrietta asked. Have you not seen Cassandra Mercer? She's smart and fun and ridiculously gorgeous. Always was, even before she had essences.
You know her? Jason asked.
I did, before we both went off adventuring. Our mothers are friends and we're the same age, so we drifted around the periphery of the same social events. Cassie liked them more than I did.
Despite being the senior adventurer, Henrietta wasn't amongst the older members of the group. She was 21 compared to Clive, who was at almost 30, Jason at 24, plus Sophie and Belinda, both about a year younger than Jason.
How is any of that Mercer family business Asano's fault? Sophie asked. They just tried to use and dismiss him, and now they're annoyed he's successful.
This is one of the problems with aristocracy, Jason said. If you teach someone that everyone else only exists for their benefit, you can't be surprised when they start using people as if they don't matter.
As an aristocrat, Humphrey said, I think the issue is more nuanced than that. Humphrey, Sophie said, every problem Lindy and I ever had was something you never had to deal with because you were born in a big estate. When Asano came along and gave me enough essences that I can be here today, that was something I never imagined having, something incredible and life-changing. But for you, there was never any doubt that not only would you get essences, but you would have your pick.
Jason, have you been poisoning Sophie with your politics? Humphrey asked.
Humphrey, were you not listening? Jason asked. We know you're one of the good ones. We've all seen how hard you work to deserve the things you have. But if you slacked off and did nothing, you'd still have them. The problem of aristocracy is that you get all the rewards and only earn them if you feel like it.
Things aren't as simple as you make out, Humphrey said.
They never are, Jason said. That doesn't obviate the fundamental problems.
You seem to know a lot about Mercer family politics, Henrietta said to Neil, sharply heading off the political discussion with a forceful change of topic.
While we were doing all that training, Neil said, following Henrietta's lead, I was finding the time when I could take tea with Thadwick's family. I think they're like having someone who knows him to talk to. There aren't a lot of those who don't completely hate him.
I think more will hate him by the time this all plays out, Clive said.
What do you mean? Neil asked.
I'm the closest thing we have to a starseed expert in Greenstone, Clive said. I was consulted as to Thadwick being seeded again when the Builder cult demonstrated so much insider knowledge of Mercer family operations during their supply raids. The thing is, the timeline from when Thadwick was retaken to when the raids began is too short for that to explain his behavior. The seed would have needed longer to supplant his original personality to the point he gave up such important family secrets.
You're suggesting Thadwick gave up the information voluntarily, Jason said.
That would make sense, Neil said. Thadwick's family got awkward a couple of times when we were talking, and I didn't realize why at the time. If they already knew what you just told us, that explains a lot.
Of course I told them, Clive said. They deserve to know more than anyone.
You think he threw in with the cultists? Belinda asked.
Not even Thadwick would fall that low,
Jason said. They already captured him and implanted one of those things in him once. Even he wouldn't be stupid enough to volunteer for another go-around.
You think they just tortured the information out of him? Henrietta said.
It would make sense, Humphrey said. I don't like to speak ill of a man probably in terrible circumstances right now, but he seems like someone who would give up under interrogation rather quickly.
And so he should, Jason said. Everyone's going to break eventually, so you might as well save yourself the torture. I would.
You'd give up information under torture?
Humphrey asked. Why wait for it to start? Jason asked. I'd give up under just the threat of torture. I don't want to get tortured. I'd crack like an egg.
They made their way along the coast road, afternoon closing in on evening, as they got closer to the dividing line where the delta met the desert. The Magic Society maintained outposts at the edge of the delta where spirit coin shipments were inspected, before being handed over from adventurer escorts to the Duke of Greenstone's people for transport into the city. The plan was to stay at one of the outposts overnight before heading into the desert in the morning. The team was riding a heavy skimmer that floated smoothly over the road like a hovercraft. Larger and more expensive than skimmers they had used in the past, it was a big 10-seater. It used magic to prevent the rush of air propelling it forward to seeming loud to the passengers, allowing them to converse. They discussed the silver rank elemental that had appeared in the city and whether it was a sign of the monster surge finally beginning.
There are certainly indicators that it might be, Clive said. A monster surge is kind of like water building up behind a dam, except with magic. If too much builds up before being sluiced out in the form of a monster surge, you end up with some flooding when it finally does. The fact that so many subordinate monsters appeared alongside the silver-ranked one indicates that there's a significant build-up. Being an elemental is another indicator. Elementals are basically just ordinary materials infused with magic, which is why so much material was left behind even after the elementals were looted and went up in rainbow smoke. That kind of monster manifestation is more common as magic builds up before a surge.
With both Neil and Jason on hand, plenty of looting went on in the wake of the elemental fight. Mostly it was water and corrupt quintessence, but there was also a corrupt essence from the largest elemental. That loot was Bertrand's, given he killed it, and he was going to hand it over to the Adventure Society since it was on the restricted essence list.
Does that mean there can be a dam break situation? Jason asked. I kind of assumed that was what the monster surges were.
That sounds bad, Neil said.
The monster surges are part of our world's natural magical cycles, Clive said. That's why I compared them to a sluice being opened, because they are part of the normal functioning. A dam break would be such a mass of magic building up without release that, like a dam break, it would fundamentally damage the structure of the world. The dam, in this case, is the membrane between our physical reality and the astral. Permanent damage to that membrane would be very, very bad, yes.
What would that look like? Henrietta asked.
I can't be sure, Clive said. It would open our world up to astral forces from which it's normally protected, but the results of that are pure conjecture. The idea has been thrown around, but not in any serious capacity, because it just shouldn't happen. The natural venting process of the monster surge would kick in well before reaching that point. It would only be possible with some kind of outside intervention, but we're talking about a world-altering power scale. People have bandied around ideas about how that might work, because surges have been taking longer to arrive. But that is conspiratorial rubbish. We don't even have the beginnings of the kind of astral magic that would take.
Don't we? Jason asked. How's that extra reading I gave you going?
Jason, it's a big jump between some new revelations in astral magic and altering the magic of a whole world. It just isn't possible.
Clive, Jason said. A year ago, I didn't know magic was real. The moment that I accepted that it was, really accepted that it was, I realized that there is no such thing as impossible.
Humphrey gave Jason an assessing look.
I think I just came a little closer to figuring out how you think, he told Jason.
I wouldn't try that if I were you, Neil said. Getting inside that mind is like putting your hand on the fire.
Or a trap,
Sophie added. You don't know that, Jason said. Come, Neil, and bathe in the comforting warmth of my thoughts.
I'd rather bathe in that turd elemental, Neil said.
The group laughed at Jason's mock-hurt expression.
You never answered the original question, Clive, Sophie said. Do you think this is the start of a monster surge?
Maybe,
Clive said. Roaming around during a monster surge is like travelling in the astral space city where the Reaper trials were conducted. You won't go much more than an hour or two without some monster jumping you, and we've been riding all afternoon without incident. This might be some kind of flare-up as a precursor to the surge, but those can happen weeks, even months ahead.
So it's just another monster manifestation? Sophie asked.
I know it feels like it means something because the monster appeared in the city, but that is just us ascribing meaning that isn't there. To a monster manifestation, the city means nothing. It's no more or less likely to appear in a city as anywhere else, but when it appears in the city instead of the wilderness, it feels different to us. That's why the inclination is to see it as somehow different when it isn't. Being a silver rank manifestation just adds to that. They do happen here, albeit rarely.
How long can it take between surges?
Belinda asked.
What's the record?
Just under 14 years, Clive said. That was a famously bad one. It's over 12 and counting this time.
Maybe I'm overthinking it, Humphrey said, with everything that's happening with the Builder cult and the Church of Purity. I can't help but feel all this is building up to something. Something bigger than what we've seen.
Let's hope not, Henrietta said. You know that not everywhere has managed to stop the cult of the Builder. Most of the big places found and shut them down, but there have been towns and rural areas wiped out when the local astral spaces were ripped off the side of our world. My team scouted one out before we split up to go protect our hometowns. The outskirts were devastated, like a hurricane had passed through. The actual area itself was worse. There was nothing left. No plants, no building, no life. Just a huge gaping hole in the landscape.
How big an area? Neil asked.
The size of a lake, Henrietta said. A big one.
You've all heard of the legend of Skyscar Lake, that a god made it to punish some sinners that were living there. That's what it was like, as if some god came down and scooped the land out.
That's horrifying, Belinda said.
Mostly it's been small places, Henrietta said. Rural areas or even wilderness, where there aren't enough, if any, adventurers to find and stop them. Word came in just yesterday of a city of 12,000 people being lost. It's the biggest so far, and no one thinks the cultists are done.
I didn't realize things were so bad, Neil said.
You have to realize that Greenstone isn't a priority compared to the rest of the world, Henrietta said. You're only seeing the periphery of a larger conflict. The cult has been largely blunted here, and there's only so much more damage they can do.
I wouldn't be so sure, Clive said. We know from Jason's familiar that some people stayed behind when the astral space was resealed. Emir and his people have been looking for a way back inside.
Jason stayed quiet. He had put the issue of getting back inside the astral space to Shade, who had said it was a possibility, but not yet. The astral space had originally been stabilized by Shade's former summoner, who used his own essence abilities as a foundation for much of the infrastructure. That meant installing his own familiar as an administrator and building the archway portals based on his teleportation ability, Path of Shadows. Shade had postulated that once Jason's own Path of Shadows power reached bronze rank and could open portals, then between it, Shade's own knowledge of the infrastructure, and a sufficiently skilled astral magic specialist, it might be possible to send people back into the astral space. Jason had, thus far, not shared this with anyone, as there were no guarantees. Opening his mouth now would just put a target on his back as the cult tried to kill him off before he ranked his power up.
Coming back here is a risk, Timos said. Our situation is desperate, Zato said.